From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
I mean, it's only rock and roll, honey.
Today, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. He'll tell us about starting the band and writing songs with Mick Jagger and becoming famous. He'll also tell us about creating his transformative guitar sound. It involved plugging his guitar into a cassette machine.
Because there I am, I now have my hands on the best amplifiers in the world and the best guitars. But I'm trying to translate another sound in my head that I can't find through conventional means.
Richards has a new solo album called Cross-Eyed Heart, his first in over 20 years. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Sicario, the new action thriller set in the world of the U.S.-Mexico drug wars. It stars Emily Blunt, Josh Brolin, and Benicio del Toro. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might want to check out, How to Do Everything with Mike and Ian. They're the answer to the question, what if MacGyver worked at NPR? When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are there for you. You can find How to Do Everything at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards has a new album called Cross-Eyed Heart, his first solo release in more than 20 years. He's also the subject of a new documentary called Under the Influence, which premieres today on Netflix. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Richards, recorded when he'd published his autobiography. As you'd expect, there are plenty of details about excess and drugs, but it's also filled with stories about growing up in post-war England, discovering the blues, songwriting, forming the Rolling Stones, being targeted by police who saw the Stones as a bad influence on youth, becoming megastars, playing stadiums, kicking heroin, his sometimes rocky relationship with Mick Jagger, getting older, and so on. Richards co-wrote much of the Stones' repertoire with Jagger, including Satisfaction, Let's Spend the Night Together, Get Off of My Cloud, Gimme Shelter, Sympathy for the Devil, and Beast of Burden. Before we listen to that interview, let's hear a track from Richards' new album, Cross-Eyed Heart. This is called Trouble.
Off the streets again. That don't mean that I can help you, or I ain't your friend. Maybe trouble is your middle name. The trouble is that your game. Now you're out of circulation, out of reach, and out of touch.
Terry spoke with Keith Richards in 2010 about his autobiography called Life.
You have a great story in your book about how you co-wrote, well, how you got Satisfaction started. You co-wrote the song with Mick Jagger, but you originated it and you didn't know you were doing it. Can you?
I wish all the songs could come this way, you know, but you just dream of them. And then the next morning, there they are, presented to you. But Satisfaction was that sort of miracle that took place. I had one of the first little cassette players, you know, Norelco, whatever, Philips, the same thing, really. But it was a fascinating little machine to me, a cassette player, that you could actually just lay ideas down, and, you know, wherever you were. I set the machine up and I put in a fresh tape. I go to bed as usual with my guitar, and I wake up the next morning. I see that the tape has run to the very end, and I think, well, I didn't do anything. You know? I said, maybe I hit a button while I was asleep, you know. So I put it back to the beginning and push play. And then some sort of ghostly version is... I can't get no satisfaction. And so there's a whole verse of it. I won't bore you with it all. And after that, there's, I don't know, 40 minutes of me snoring. But there's the song, and it's embryo, and I actually dreamt the damn thing, you know what I mean? And I'm still waiting for another dream.
Okay, so you bring this germ of a song, basically the first verse, to Mick Jagger, and then you flesh it out into a more complete song. What's the process between you and him in making a full song out of what came to you?
Well, at least in those days, and pretty much throughout the whole thing, is I'll come up with a riff, the idea, and maybe the subject matter, the title, and then I go on to write the next one, and Mick would flesh out and finish it off and make it into a real song. I come up with ideas. Mick turns it into a finished product, you know? And we were working so hard in those days that you couldn't write them fast enough. So any idea I came, I'd shove it to Mick, and Mick would work on that, and I'd have another idea with a bit of luck. Yeah.
Now, how did the line, "I can't get no satisfaction," come to you at a time when you should have been having a lot of very satisfying, gratifying moments?
Darling, I don't know. I dreamt it.
No, true. Okay.
I mean, nobody's ever satisfied, right? And it was just a phrase that obviously, you know, was buzzing through the mind. And whether you could express anything or enlarge on that idea. Because otherwise I can't get any satisfaction. It's kind of, you know, sort of moaning. But then you can take it and expand it, and which Mick did brilliantly. There it is. I mean, these things are all made out of just little sparks of ideas that come to you, and you're lucky to be around to grab them. And that's kind of basically the process of how we work.
The Rolling Stones, and my guest is Keith Richards, and he's written his autobiography. It's called Life. Now, that cassette that you mentioned that you used to mm-hmm. write down the idea for satisfaction in the middle of the night, that so surprised you when you played it back in the morning, that cassette or one just like it was also really helpful to you in coming up with a kind of transformative guitar sound. Would you describe how you would plug your acoustic guitar in motel rooms into
it's a good question. You know, I'll try, because there I am. I now have my hands on the best amplifiers in the world and the best guitars, but I'm trying to translate another sound in my head that I can't find through conventional means. I was at the time, I always play a lot of acoustic guitar. And the cassette machine gave it, in those days, before they had things on them called governors, which means that you could not overload the machinery. I would just shove the acoustic guitar and use basically, I would use the cassette player as an amplifier, basically, and overload the acoustic guitar so it becomes an electric guitar. But at the same time, you see, you still have that feel of an acoustic, which is totally different to an electric. So I'm still looking for the perfect example of this, but I'm going to keep going. You know?
So what you would get is like an electrified acoustic guitar that was also distorted.
Exactly. You got it, Terry. You got it. That's it. I was trying to get the quality and the touch that you can get from an acoustic guitar and then overload it and make it sound like an electric guitar. But at the same time, you have that original acoustic touch because... You know, this gets complicated because guitars are strange animals. but there's a touch that you can get off an acoustic guitar that you'll never get off an electric. And so I was trying to figure how to electrify the acoustic feel and still translate it. And so that was the name of the game. That was it.
Now, it was surprising enough to me to read how you did this in your motel room, but then reading how you did it also in the recording studio was fascinating, that you wanted that sound so much that you brought in the cassette machine and plugged your acoustic guitar into it.
Yes, I mean, I took these ideas and we the Stones were in the studio and we were all looking at it and saying, it doesn't have what you had on the, on the original idea. And so finally, after many attempts to try and reproduce this sort of idea, with amplifiers and, conventionally, I think it was Charlie Watts maybe, let's go back to how you did it in the first place and work it from there, which is why you got Street Fighting Man and Jumping Jack Flashes. There are no electric guitars at all. It's just overloaded acoustics. I don't know, I like that denseness of color, of feel that you can get out of that. And it's an experiment I might take up again once they start making cassette machines again.
So, do you think Jumpin' Jack Flash is a good illustration of what you're doing?
Yeah, and Street Fighting Man is probably another great example of it.
Which one would you rather hear?
I love them both, honey. Don't ask me to cut the babies in half.
All right, so we'll go with Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Go there. All right, yeah.
Since you were so into rhythm and blues when you were in your early teens and in your teens, I found it so interesting that you learned to sing in a school choir and that you were taunted for being in the choir. What did you like about the choir and what did you learn from being in it?
It was just a way to get out of chemistry and physics. and I had a soprano that worked. But really, it was just about music and it was... joining a choir, at least you got to hang around with guys that liked to sing and liked music. And I had a great choir master who was very severe, but same sort of taught you a lot about, you know, how to hold your notes and when to let them go.
Now, I remember when the Stones started to record that in America we were expected to pick a team. Who do you like best, the Stones or the Beatles?
And the competition thing, yeah.
Yeah, and you write about, you know, what when the Stones started getting going, that you didn't want to copy the Beatles, and you decided to be the anti-Beatles. So what did that mean in terms of your music and your image?
You know, I think, yeah, if you're talking image-wise, we probably did make a sort of decision to not be the Fab Four. I think, although there were different, basically differences between the bands. The Beatles were basically a vocal band. You know, they all sang, and one song John would take the lead, another Paul, another George, and sometimes Ringo, right? But our band set up totally differently, with one front man, one lead singer, right? And what I loved about it was that there's an incredible difference in that way between the Beatles and ourselves. But at the same time, you're there at the same time, and you're dealing with each other, you know, and it was a very, very fruitful and great relationship between the Stones and the Beatles. It was very, very friendly. The competition thing didn't come into it, as far as we were concerned.
Now, you say your manager of the time, Andrew Loog Oldham, played the difference between the Stones and the Beatles to the hilt. What did he do to try to emphasize what was different about the Stones?
I don't know. He had worked with the Beatles in a PR capacity. He had a falling out with Brian Epstein, who was the Beatles' manager. And I guess what Andrew thought was that the Beatles can't be the only four guys in England, or four or five or whatever, you know, that there's other things out there. And he'd heard about us, came by, and realized that here was a room to maneuver, you know, that we're not trying to compete with the Beatles, we just want to make records. And at the same time, he saw how from the image point of view and how to present the Stones was to be not the Fab Four. You know, we forget, you know, the neat haircuts and the suits and stuff, because quite honestly, Andrew found out that there's no way you're going to get the Stones into suits very long. You know, we'd sell them.
Your first album was mostly covers of rhythm and blues songs, and you say that your manager of the time, Andrew Oldham, wanted the Stones to write more originals, so he basically locked you in a room and had you start writing.
True.
And the first song you co-wrote during this episode was As Tears Go By, which Marianne Faithfull had a big hit of. But you say you couldn't have given it to the Stones. They would have laughed you or thrown you out of the room. Why? Yeah. Why did he think? It's. I love that Marianne Faithfull recording. Why? Do you think it's a bad song or just the wrong song for the Stones?
I tell you what, I think that when you're just starting to write songs, but you have a band, you know, it'll take you a while to figure out how to write for that band. Mm-hmm. And so first off, we had to write just a song, one song. Hey, Mick and I wanted to get out of that kitchen. We'd come up with anything, you know. But we worked, and we came out with As Tears Go By. And because Marianne did it, and it did very well, it gave Mick and myself confidence that, well, at least we can write songs. And the next step is can we write songs for the Rolling Stones? Can we actually walk into the room with the guys and say, let's try this on for size? And it took us a while to get there. Meanwhile, we were like learning our game and cutting our chops, you know.
Keith Richards speaking with Terry Gross in 2010. Richards has a new solo album called Cross-Eyed Heart. After a break, he'll talk about what it was like being mobbed by teenage girls and about his relationship with Mick Jagger. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from PBS. Travel to Africa to experience the rewilding of a paradise once decimated by war. In this unprecedented project, filmmakers, scientists, and local rangers join forces to build an inspirational new beginning and create a model for rehabilitating the world's endangered wild places. Gorongosa Park, Rebirth of Paradise, premieres Tuesday, September 22nd at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And streaming now on PBS Anywhere platforms.
So the Rolling Stones become global stars. And as you become global stars, you write about how you go to concerts and girls are throwing their underwear and themselves at you. And you say armies of feral body-snatching girls began to emerge in big numbers about halfway through a first UK tour in the fall of 63. The power of teenage females of 13, 14, 15 when they're in a gang has never left me. They nearly killed me. If they get their hands on you, though, they don't know what to do with you. So,
it's true.
Would you describe one of those experiences for us, what it was like for you early on when that started
happening? The most graphic is trying to leave a theater in, I think it was in the north of England, somewhere up in the north. And they brought the cops up to kind of control the crowd, which consisted of basically just young teenage girls, you know. Everybody rushes through, the whole band, they get through, they get in the car. I'm the last one out of the stage door, and silly me, I was wearing a kind of chain around my neck, and some chick from the left got hold of one side, and some chick from the right got the other side. And to cut a long story short, quite honestly, I woke up in the garbage can, and to see the Stones car without minus a door zooming off in the horizon, and I'm just left lying there with maybe a half a shirt and a shoe. Things like that happen nearly every day. It's crazy.
Then there are the songs that you describe as anti-girl songs that the Stones did, like Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, Out of Time, Yesterday's Papers. And this is where I've been so ambivalent about some of the Stones songs, like Under My Thumb. Under My Thumb is so catchy. I mean, I think it's just like irresistible what's going on, like melodically and rhythmically in there. And then, you know, I catch myself singing along, and what am I singing, you know, like about this girl who's like under his thumb. And so anyways, were you ever ambivalent about that?
Let me try and break in here.
Go ahead.
Terry, let
me
break in here and say, you can take it as male, female, or it's just people. I mean, it could be about a guy. It could have been, this is just a guy thing, that probably you're actually under her thumb. And you're just trying to fight back, these are all the relationships and stuff, and I wouldn't take it as any sexism. I can't even go there, but I don't think about it. I just think, we know what some people are like, and those things happen. Anyway, I didn't write the lyrics.
Cut to the chase. Off the hook. A little bit about Altamont, which was the music festival in which at the Altamont Raceway in California, which one man was stabbed to death and three others died accidentally. This was a free concert, and you describe how you'd asked the Grateful Dead, by you I mean the Rolling Stones, had asked the Grateful Dead to help organize it because they had a lot of experience with free concerts. And the permits that you'd expected to get for Golden Gate Park and another place or two fell through. And by that time, Altamont was the only place available. So when you were on stage there, at what point did you know things were really taking a bad turn and that this wasn't like a Woodstock concert? There were some really nasty things happening in the audience.
There was the potential for nasty things, and nasty things did happen. From my point of view, I was amazed that that was all that happened. The man who's good, he was asking for trouble, and you have the Hell's Angels there. Basically, from my point of view, I'd say I realized this thing was getting dodgy just by looking at the Angels.
Who were hired to do the security? I think I might have neglected to mention
like,
that.
The Grateful Dead's guys, and they've said, oh, no problem, these guys, we work with them, and blah, blah. And say, okay, we just want to know how to do. We just want to throw a free one, Also, a unique time for America, 1969, that when there were no cops around. It was just go off and do what you want to do, There was no control, except what people could exert themselves. I think... he threw a show. Yeah, he said, hey, wanted to be free. Everybody come. Then it's up to everybody else how they conduct themselves. And it was a very, very weird feeling in the middle of nowhere. You know, Altamont is basically, you know, Mars. And there was nobody else to turn to except who? The Hell's Angels. I'm not going to turn to them. They're all on acid. And Thunderbird Wine.
Did you decide at that point what would be the best song to play to quiet things down as opposed to amp things up?
I don't know about whether it was the right song to play, but I think we went into Sympathy of the Devil.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah, but I think we just wanted something with a rhythm. Just it didn't really, by then, nobody could hear what anybody was singing or saying or anything. It was just like, hey, you know when there's a fight in a bar room and the band stops and then some stuff goes down and they're like, play some music, whatever it is. We don't give a damn. Just play, you know, just divert attention.
We'll hear more of Terry's 2010 interview with Keith Richards after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Getty Images. Great photography has the power to move culture, highlight injustice, bring understanding, and change minds. Getty Images believes that the difference between looking and seeing is the power of the image. Getty Images provides the highest quality collection of images from world-renowned artists, curated with expertise. So visit GettyImages.com and see what an image can do.
Let me ask you about your relationship with Mick Jagger. You grew up in the same neighborhood. You've known him since you were a boy. You were obviously very close for a long period of time, co-wrote so many songs together. But at the same time, you write about
hey,
about
there's
how
problems down the road. Yeah,
yeah, about how
right.
In the beginning of the
80s. Let me preempt you.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I mean, you think in a 50-year relationship doing this stuff that there's not going to be some conflict, some disagreements? Of course there's going to be.
But you describe him as having become unbearable in the early 80s.
At times, yes.
What made him unbearable in those times?
An attitude, it's all in the book. And I don't want to expand on it with you, Terry. What I've said is in the book. I can't say anything more than that.
Well, let me quote something that you say in the book, and this was, you write how, you know, in the early 80s, this is right after you had kicked heroin, and you said, Mick seemed to like one side of me being a junkie, the one that kept me from interfering in day-to-day business. And you say that after you kicked, you wanted a more active say in what the band did, but apparently Mick Jagger didn't really want you to have one? Do I read that right?
Yeah. You know, so he got used to holding the reins and... And that was a bit of a shock to me at the time, but I got to live with it. And anyway, actually what happened is that we ended up sharing the reins again. But at the time, yeah, that did shock me. Or disappointed me, to say. I mean, shock, I'm beyond, you know. But, and I'd leave it at that, quite honestly. It was a bit of a surprise to me at the time. And also, but it gave me more of an insight into Mick himself. You know, I said, hey, man, you know, all right, go for it. You know, I mean, it's only rock and roll, honey.
So just one more question about this, which is when you were performing on stage together during this period of great friction, do you feel it on stage? Did you try to prevent the audience from feeling that friction?
Get out of here. This is a bunch of guys that have been together for yonks. You know, I mean, you don't carry stuff like this onto stage. These are things that just happen and you deal with them and you get it over with. You know, forget about it. It's, this is not some angst or a big deal, you know. You know, of course, guys have fights, brothers have fights all the time. That's what it's all about. It's, to pick one thing out and say, like, oh, it's a festering wound, what rubbish. No, you know, we're brothers. We get along and we fight sometimes. And I don't think I can express it any better than that.
So I'm going to play Beast of Burden. Do you want to say anything about writing it or what you're playing on it?
No, I loved it. It's another one that came very natural. sitting around with Mick and Mick, see, I write songs for Mick to think. That's what I do. I mean, you don't get Midnight Ramblers out of nowhere. You don't get Gimme Shelters out of nowhere. I'm writing because I say, man, I know this guy can handle this and nobody will ever be able to handle it any other way. What I do is write songs for Mick to sing. And if he picks up on it, baby, we got. You know, if he doesn't, I just let it sit on the shelf.
What are the qualities in his voice and in his personality that you feel you're writing for?
He's an outstanding performer. Hey, you're talking about a mixture of James Brown and Maria Callas here. You know? I gotcha.
That's good.
Yeah. And to have to work with such an outsized personality, ego, and say, hey, whatever it takes, it's there. And you gotta, you know, you gotta go for it. And sometimes it doesn't work, and a lot of times it does. And so you just keep on pushing, you know.
So let's hear "Beast of Burden," and this is from the Stones' 19.
Please do. I love that one.
Me too. The 1978 album "Some Girls," "Beast of Burden." Survived so many things in your life, including a heroin habit, a car accident, a cerebral hematoma. Of all the things that you survived...
Is that what I had?
That's what you say you had.
I didn't ever knew what they called it, honey.
So, yeah, you fell out of a tree, is that right?
Yeah. I fell out of a damn tree and bashed my head.
So, of all the things that you've survived, was there any one time where you really felt this is it?
Well, there's been a few times flying through the air and a Mercedes upside down and hitting the ground three times where you do kind of sort of get the hint that maybe this is it. But if it ain't it, then you just carry on with life, right? I mean, boom, we all bump into death one time or another, honey.
What do you want from the next stage of your life as you approach your 70s?
Well, I'm looking to be about 120.
Okay.
But, I don't know what I'm going to do with it. Quite honestly, I think there's the band wants to play, the boys want to play together, and hopefully, you know, we can get on the ups here. And we're thinking ahead, you know. I mean, I know, obviously, because of this, the book and everything, that... there's a lot of retro going on and stuff, but as far as I'm concerned, I think as far as Mick's concerned and Charlie and Ronnie, get it over, get over it. Let's get on ahead. You know, we want to make some records and we want to do some good shows, and we believe that we have it in us to do that.
You say in the book that people are saying, oh, the Stones are still at it, and they're getting so old, you know, and...
But they said that to Duke Ellington and Count Basie. I'm keeping a band together here.
Exactly. That's what you say. If it was Basie or Ellington, they wouldn't be talking that way. But you know, rock and roll was considered a youth music.
So we're here to grow up rock and roll.
Right.
And see how far it can go.
And that's my question. As grown-ups approaching your 70s, what's different about what you want to do on stage and what you want to sing on stage?
I don't know. This is what we're thinking about. This is a good question, you know. I mean, how do we want to do it? How can the Stones grow up? I mean, you've got to get like kicking 70 to figure a thing like that out. I don't know. We'll find out.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. And, you know, all best to you. Thank you very much.
Hey, Terry. Thanks very much. Good try, honey.
Keith Richards, guitarist for the Rolling Stones. He spoke with Terry in 2010 when his autobiography, Life, was published. Richards has a new solo album called Cross-Eyed Heart. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new action thriller Sicario, set in the U.S.-Mexican drug wars. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ZipRecruiter, who understands that your company is only as good as the people you hire, and that when you're short-staffed, there's no time to deal with all the different job sites. At ZipRecruiter, you can post up to 100-plus job sites with one single click and have the highest chance of finding that perfect candidate. Plus, you can instantly be matched to candidates from more than 6 million resumes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/freshair.
Sicario is an ancient word for assassin that's been resurrected by Colombian and Mexican drug cartels to describe a modern-day hitman. It's also the name of a new film about a military task force on the hunt for a notorious drug lord. The film stars Emily Blunt as an FBI agent, along with Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
From watching his films, it's clear the Quebec-born director Denis Villeneuve hates violence on a level so visceral he has to distance himself from what he's showing. He mourns his own images. His tone lifts the action thriller Sicario far above movies of its ilk. The posters show top-billed Emily Blunt in combat apparel in the foreground, looking pensive but poised for battle, in control. That's not the case in the movie itself. The FBI agent she plays, Kate Macer, is like Alice in Cartel Land. She falls into a world of moral chaos. The film is stupendous, and I'm guessing it's meant as an answer to Zero Dark Thirty, which suggested going over to the dark side was the only way to win the war on terror. This war, on drugs, has had, in the movie's view, a few more decades to prove itself unwinnable, and its front lines make an even starker prism through which to view the strategies of U.S. intelligence agencies. Sicario opens in bloody confusion, with a thunderous assault on a compound said to be packed with drug war hostages. Blunt's Kate is still shaking from the subsequent deaths of her colleagues, when her FBI boss, played by Victor Garber, summons her into a room with a mysterious intelligence officer named Matt, played by Josh Brolin. The discussion turns to the deadliest of Mexican drug lords, Diaz.
We're going to go see Guillermo.
Diaz's brother.
That's the one.
Where is he?
He's in the El Paso area.
What's our objective?
To dramatically overreact.
Kate, you must volunteer for an interagency task force. Think very hard before you respond. You want to be a part of this?
Do we get an opportunity of the men responsible for today?
The men who are really responsible for today, yeah.
Matt's line about going to the El Paso area turns out to be whoppingly incomplete. The destination is over the Bridge of the Americas, from El Paso to Juarez, Mexico, a virtual war zone. Crossing that bridge means potentially violating domestic and international laws. Why, Kate asks, are they doing this? And who is the man called Alejandro, played by Benicio del Toro, who sits across from her in planes and armored vehicles in silence, staring at nothing? For most of Sicario's running time, the narrative is murky, oblique, taking place in the aftermath of decisions made somewhere else, based on events unfolding over decades. As Kate comes to understand she's a cog in a black op, Blunt does more and more with her eyes, her open mouth, her body that goes one way, its muscles trained to obey, while her mind cries, "Whoa." It's a beautifully reactive performance. Around her, director Villeneuve, the great expressionist cinematographer Roger Deakins, and composer Johan Johansson create a scrambled, alien world in which harsh-lit desert landscapes give way to black tunnels. When Kate descends into one, Johansson comes up with a noise that's like the earth giving up a final groan. Villeneuve doesn't linger on the cruelties, as he did in his great 2010 film Incendie, partially set in an unnamed Mideast country, much like Lebanon. But every road leads to hell. A subplot centers on the young Mexican son of a man who comes and goes mysteriously, plainly riddled with anxiety. We don't know where the dad fits into the story until later, but we get the point that Mexico, since overtaking Colombia as the dominant player in Latin American terror, is no country for old or young men, or women, or children. The lens of Sicario finally settles on Del Toro, whose sad, heavy eyes don't prepare us for the swiftness of his brutality. He wreaks havoc on our sympathies. We dread the failure of his mission, while dreading the impact of his success. More I can't say, but for a moviegoer, it's an agonizing limbo. Although Villeneuve's portrait of U.S. drug war tactics is ugly, he portrays them more in sorrow than anger. He mourns the long-term costs of short-term gains. Sicario works like gangbusters as an action thriller, except you're haunted by what thrilled you.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Five years ago, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg went on Oprah and pledged $100 million toward new programs to help Newark, New Jersey's failing schools. On Monday's show, journalist Dale Russakoff tells us about the outcome of that experiment and what it tells us about school reform. Russakoff's new book is called The Prize. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shorrock is our senior producer. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.